Wars and rumors of wars, nation rising against nation, kingdom against kingdom, but the beginning of the birth pangs. So I wrote what I wrote for the sermon today. I'm usually finished by Thursday. And so obviously everything happened Thursday night and Friday night. We'll get to that. I sort of debated whether or not I should use the same language or not, but I'm going to go ahead and do that. The prophet Jeremiah was given the task of assembling the elders of Jerusalem and giving them a word from the Lord. Well, he brought a visual aid to the meeting. It was a picture made by a potter. Prophetically, Jeremiah dramatically broke the picture in front of the elders and said, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, even so I will break this people and this city as one breaks a potter's vessel, which cannot be made whole again." Jeremiah was predicting the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. Jesus does some similar things in the Gospel of Mark and all the Gospels. As he approaches Jerusalem, he curses a fig tree and proclaims that it shall no longer bear fruit. Not long after that, he cleanses the temple and calls it a den of thieves. Now in our Gospel today, he predicts that not one stone of the temple will be left upon another. It will be totally destroyed. First Sunday of Advent, we'll look at Luke's version of this story. So today is just kind of an introduction. The teaching of Jesus is quite a bit longer in all the Gospels because the disciples are asking kind of a wide question. When will these happen? When will these things happen? And what will be the sign of the end of the age? And Jesus kind of throws all of those together in one teaching. Today we focus on what he says about the temple. The first verses of Mark 13 are Jesus' predictions about the temple. And remember, Mark was written about 60 AD. Jesus was speaking in 30s AD. The temple was destroyed in 70 AD. So this is a prediction. This is a prophecy that took place, that happened in time and space. 66 AD, Florus, the Roman procurator, that is, he had Pontius Pilate's job, arbitrarily stole a large quantity of silver from the temple. Now, this was enough for the Jews. They were tired of being oppressed by the Romans. They were tired of, like Caligula says, worship me, Nero says, worship me, which is totally forbidden. They had enough. And so they incited a riot. And Jewish rebels routed the garrison of Roman soldiers in Jerusalem in response to Florus's action. Thousands joined the zealot movement. You remember, the zealots were those who wanted to militarily take over and restore Israel to the Jews. Well, thousands then joined with the belief that they could actually overthrow the Romans. If we can do it here, we can do it anywhere. So what was the Roman response? Here's how one Jewish scholar puts it. When the Romans returned, they had 60,000 heavily armed and highly professional troops. They launched their first attack against the Jewish state's most radicalized area, ironically, Galilee, in the north. The Romans vanquished Galilee, and an estimated 100,000 Jews were killed or sold into slavery. Throughout the Roman conquest of this territory, the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem did nothing to help their beleaguered brothers in Galilee. They concluded that the revolt could not be won, and they wanted to hold down the casualties as much as they could. Well, there were those who escaped Galilee, and they went to Jerusalem. And the ones who actually escaped then took out the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem, making it easy then for the Romans to come in and take Jerusalem under General Titus and to destroy the temple. Very sad story. And then, of course, there's part two to it, Barb, which you saw at Masada. That was the last revolt. Not one stone was left upon another. What do we learn from this? The first thing is the issue of identity. What does it mean to be the people of God? The second is that everything that has a beginning has an end. Everything. First, identity. What does it mean to be the people of God? We have to understand that the destruction of the temple was a sea change for the people of God, the Jews. The temple in Jerusalem was God's literal presence with them. It was a visual icon of the promises of God to Israel that they were his people. It was a sign of their identity. However, the factions of Jerusalem's leadership played out between the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Zealots. They were all united under the Torah, but more importantly, under the temple. This is what made them a people. What are the people of God? What is Judaism? They point. There it is. There it is. The temple stood as a reminder of who the people were and what they were about. Jesus' words were a solemn warning that things were going to change. We visited Washington, D.C. this summer, and the buildings and symbols on the mall of the Capitol are stunning. And it feels ageless, does it not? Lincoln Memorial especially struck me. You look up to it, you look down from it, and you remember all of the history that has taken place there. It's as if someone were to say, this mall, this edifice of the American people, it's as if someone were to say, not one stone will be left upon another. That would be shocking to hear. Shocking. The destruction of the temple was a sea change. It was destroyed once before and rebuilt. But how long has it been? Almost 2,000 years. From 70 AD to the present, the children of Israel would never again see it rebuilt. Their identity had to radically change. Where do we find our identity as the people of God? What are the sources? These are very important questions. Which leads to the last point. Everything that has a beginning has an end. The temple era ended in 70 AD. The Roman Empire in its Western form ended in 476 AD. The last truly Christian empire, the Eastern Roman Empire of Byzantium, ended in 1453 under the Ottoman Turks. Jesus is truly clear when he says that the end of all things cannot be known. But whenever there is a sea change, when history turns, he calls it birth pangs. From a biblical point of view, Christ's first appearing was the beginning of the end. Every time a culture or nation's candle is snuffed from history, it's another birth pang. If we want to push that image further, the world is in its third trimester. The world is in its third trimester. But God is in control. Our identity, our beginning, our end are in the hands of God, whether it is the world, the nation, or individuals. Like I said, I wrote all these words before the events of Thursday and Friday. I got a call, actually a text, from a new friend of mine from Lebanon, Father Andre, and he said Beirut was under attack and that there were four bombers and they took out about 40 plus people. Many more were injured. And, of course, that doesn't really make our news very much, the Middle East. But it was from ISIS. And then, of course, we knew what happened in Paris. And you wonder what's happening. Well, the point of what Jesus says today is that God holds the future. That God is the Alpha and the Omega. That Christ is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. Jesus is what no temple or city or ideology or even nation can ever be. He is King. Next week we celebrate Christ the King, and it's not just a celebration on our calendar. It is to look at a very important fact. He is King. Kingdoms rise, kingdoms fall. Christ transcends everything. Itza is the hope of the world. Jesus is the answer of all of this. If you ever want to know what any response to these kinds of things should be, Matthew 5. Matthew 5. Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. You can't make this stuff up. It can only come from one source. Jesus. That is the answer. We'll have more to say about this, I'm sure.